Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. What could be funny about the abolitionist martyr John Brown? James McBride, author of the best-selling memoir The Color of Water, is here to talk about his new novel, a satire of the Civil War era.
I just thought he was fascinating and he was very moral. Deeds really mattered to him. And I wanted people to know what a great American he was.
Serial killer Charles Manson still has followers. Jeff Gwynn, whose biography of Manson is reviewed this week, will tell us what we don't know about the man behind Helter Skelter.
Dale Carnegie really was Manson's guru. Carnegie was to Manson as the Maharishi was to the Beatles.
And Parle Sagel will have bestseller news.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
James McBride is here to talk about his new novel, The Good Lord Bird, which is reviewed on this week's cover of the Book Review. Hi, James.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So this is a novel about John Brown. How did you decide to write about Brown?
I was in Maryland working on my previous novel. I think I was in Fredericksburg doing some research, and somehow I came across his name, so I took a drive to Harper's Ferry. I just became fascinated with his story.
And he's obviously been the subject of other novels and art forms. Did you have any trepidation on taking on this figure who'd already been the subject of so much writing?
A little bit, but I just loved the guy. I thought he was really interesting.
What do you love about him?
Well, people thought he was crazy. You know, they thought he was... I mean, he was way ahead of his time. This was a guy who, when... You know, at a time when blacks were considered like furniture or horses or cows or something, considered them to be human beings that were equal to him. And that was, you know, in 1850, that was still pretty big news.
Radical even among abolitionists at that time who didn't.
Absolutely, absolutely. But he did their dirty work for them, basically. I mean, John Brown was many things. He's like many of us, really. He was many things, but he was guided by this kind of moral principle that he had to do what God told him to do. And as someone who grew up in the church, you know, I kind of relate to that aspect of his life. But I didn't want it to be one of those boring, you know, books with, you know, this guy's a hero and he's, you know, those kind of books put me to sleep. So I wanted it to be funny and engaging and, you know, I wanted to write a book that I would read.
Well, our reviewer, Baz Dreisinger, starts her review by saying, calling all comedy fans, and makes it very clear that this is a very funny book. So you went in with it with the intention that this would be a satire?
I don't like reading books that are really boring and tell you this is what you must feel, and you know, this is very important because it was about slavery, and he was a great man. I mean, he was a flawed man. He was a great man. I just didn't want to write a book that was... I don't read those kinds of books. I read a lot of the books about John Brown. A lot of them, not all of them, but some of them were pretty boring and pretty sad and tragic. And he was a tragic figure, but he was more than that.
Were there good books that you read about John Brown? Any that served, informative in terms of your own...
Well, all of them were informative. I mean, some books... The books are like almost evenly divided, you know, with books that kind of treat him as a figure that's not kind of beyond understanding, a kind of wild quack who was a failed businessman, and not a quack, but a wild person who was a little bit off of his rocker. And the later books treat him as a more serious character. I know Stephen Oates' book, Purge the Slam with Blood, is a really good book, even though it's about 20 years old. And there's a newer book by, I think his name is David Reynolds, who teaches at Baruch. He did a real good history book on John Brown. I must have read about 20 or 25, maybe 30 books and pamphlets and newspapers. I mean, there's a lot of information on him, but a lot of people still don't know about him. He should be like Jesse James, really.
What did you feel like you wanted to make known about Brown that didn't come through in these earlier books?
Well, first of all, I didn't care what the earlier books did. I just thought he was fascinating and he was very moral. deeds really mattered to him. And I wanted people to know what a great American he was and how he was a catalyst for the Civil War, and he was a tragic hero that we should study and to some degree admire.
When you were working on this book, obviously, I'm assuming it took more than a year to write. Did you think, once you knew that it was going to come out now, which is, of course, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, another great demonstration for civil rights that took place almost 100 years after Harper's Ferry. Did you think about that timing and sort of think about what this novel means to people today?
No. I don't pay too much attention to politics. I mean, I read about it, but I hate politics, really.
Why do you hate politics?
I was a journalist for a long time. That's why. And I didn't pay any attention to that because politics has a way of dulling the truth and flattening out real history and twisting it and spinning it so that someone else is always right and you're not right. I didn't pay any attention to that. I didn't pay 2 cents worth of attention to the March on Washington, the 50th anniversary of it. I just thought, this is a great Western story. And this was a great man. And he dealt with a lot of really interesting people. Many of whom were African-American, who people don't really know about, and many of whom were white. Most of my work deals with the commonality of the human condition, particularly us as Americans. I'm always looking, because of my background, I'm always looking for the place where we have something in common. And we all have John Brown in common. We all have a John Brown in us, if you will. But few of us have the guts to actually do what he did and have the savagery within us to do what he did as well, because he did some savage things also.
Now, John Brown is obviously a focus in the book, but your main character is a young slave boy. Tell us about Henry Shackelford.
Well, Henry Shackelford is a boy who gets kidnapped by Brown at the beginning of the book when a fight in a tavern goes sour.
This is in Kansas, Territory.
Yeah, this book begins in Kansas Territory where Brown really got started. And where the Civil War really essentially began, when the pro-slavers and the abolitionists started to go at each other about the question of slavery in Kansas. So John Brown walks into a tavern in disguise, trying to figure out what's going on. He's got a $1,500 reward on his head. Someone figures it out. A fight happens. Guns are yanked out, and this fight goes bad. And John Brown takes this little boy to freedom, but he thinks it's a girl. And so Henry, out of fear, decides to just continue being a girl. And he plays as a girl throughout the entire book, which sets up a lot of good comedy situations. And
so it starts off with John Brown in disguise, and then it continues with Henry in disguise.
That's right, yeah. That's one way of looking at it. I never thought of it that way, yeah. And John Brown's not very good at disguising himself because he can't smile. He's very serious. He's always talking about God. I mean, he's a wonderful character, a guy to work into like a satire story like this. All of those people are. I weigh pretty hard on Frederick Douglass. I've already heard some comments about that. But I make fun of everybody in the book.
Right. And you also, the portrayal of the slaveholders isn't entirely sort of black and white either.
No, slaveholders were in many cases, people who were trapped by slavery. Slavery made slaves of us all, really. And so one of the elements that you can work with when you're dealing with comedy and satire that you can show the absurdity of the human condition. And this allows us to see that slave owners weren't all bad people either. I mean, I guess the extreme example is we should all stop driving cars now because there's global warming. Well, I'm not going to stop driving my Ford. If you want to stop driving your Honda, that's your business. But by God, me and my Ford are going up the road. But I tried to show the fully dimensional characters that existed in that world with some comedy attached to them.
So picking up on the comedy, our reviewer compared the book in some ways to Django Unchained, Quentin Tarantino's film from last year. Did you see that movie?
Yeah, I saw the movie after the book was done. I'm not sure that... I think my particular version of slavery is a little deeper and a little more intricately woven than Django Unchained. Django Unchained is about a guy from the Wild West and he wants to steal his wife back. And that's a true fiction movie because most slaves, any black guy walking around with that kind of hardware hanging on his belt, wouldn't go very far in America in the 1850s, I think, if that's when it took place. But, there is the absurdity of of life. And in that regard, it is similar to Django Unchained.
I guess the other thing that that she was pointing to, the reviewer, is the use of humor as a way to shed light on slavery or to see it in a different way in that whole era. And that seems to be something we, you know, that we didn't do 50 years ago.
You know, 50 years ago, I don't think we'd be ready for a book like this. It's hard to be funny about slavery when the vestiges of it still exist in our society now. I guess the ascension of Barack Obama into American life has helped us all in that regard. But also, I just love the voice of the old black man who talks in that old country twang. And that's the kind of people I grew up with. And I felt it could carry a story like this and not offend too many people. This book is not meant to be offensive. And if you're offended by it, you just want to be offended. I hope that it's effective in bringing John Brown into the mythology of modern American historical discourse. That's really, you know, I suppose my deep, deep hope.
Well, our reviewer certainly gave it what could only be called a rave. So congratulations on the new book. And let's hope audiences or readers are ready for it.
I hope they are.
Okay. Thanks so much, James.
Thank you.
That was James McBride talking about his new novel, The Good Lord Bird, reviewed this week on our cover.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Self-Inflicted Wounds, Heartwarming Tales of Epic Humiliation, written and read by Aisha Tyler. That's Self-Inflicted Wounds, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Jeff Gwynn joins us today. He is the author of Manson, The Life and Times of Charles Manson, a new biography. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. So you got to ask, why did you want to delve into this, the figure of the notorious killer?
What I wanted to do was write a book that took place in the late 1960s, because it was such a unique time in American history. And when I write my books and pick an era I want to write about, I try to find an iconic figure or event from that period so that readers who may be interested just in the person or the one thing that happened will be drawn in and maybe get more context. I thought about a lot of subjects, the Weathermen, the SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. But then when I looked into the Manson books that had been written, there still wasn't the one I wanted to read. It seemed as though most people who wrote about him thought he emerged full-blown in Los Angeles in 1968 or 69. And I wanted to answer the question, if he's such a monster, how did we grow him? And tell the whole life story and see how he fit into the times and places where he lived. So I've spent the last 3 years focusing on Charles Manson, and it's been a very interesting ride, I've got to say.
Did you meet him?
For 5 months, I sent him a letter a day asking to come visit in prison, but he had lost his visitor privileges because in two times he was caught with a cell phone and once with a shank. He sharpened a toothbrush handle. 78 years old, but he's still up to these things.
He has not changed his ways.
No, he has not, but he's been this way since he was a child, as we learned from his sister and cousin. At any rate, he finally wrote back to me a very unpleasant letter, expressing the fact that he did not want this book to be written. Later on, he did give me permission to use some of his artwork in the photo section of the book, and he kindly passed along my contact information to some of his current followers. And there are a lot of them out there, surprisingly.
That's a whole other story.
Yes, it is.
What is his artwork like?
He likes to draw swastikas, spiders, and work in the word helter-skelter.
All right, Colin the psychologist, Colin Freud. So who was he? Who was the baby Manson? Who was he born to? Where did he grow up?
Just about everything Manson has told us about his childhood was a lie. I was able to find his sister. I was able to find his cousin. He likes to say that he was the illegitimate son of a teenage prostitute. He was not illegitimate. His mother was not a prostitute. She did go to jail for 3 years for one of the most spectacularly bungled robberies.
She used a ketchup bottle as a weapon?
Yeah, she and her brother stuck a ketchup bottle, empty ketchup bottle, in the back of a man and told him, put his hands up, it's a gun. When he stopped laughing and called the police, she ended up getting 5 years. And Manson then lived with his uncle and aunt and cousin. But from the time he was a child, his first week in elementary school, he gets some of the girls in his class to beat up a boy he doesn't like. He's brought into the principal's office and tells the principal the girls were just doing what they wanted to do. It's not my responsibility. The exact same defense he uses for Tate LaBianca 32 years later.
And who is his father?
His father was a man named Colonel Scott. That's not a military rank. That was his given name. But his mother, when she was 4 months pregnant with Manson, married William Manson, a dry cleaner. So there was never any hint that Manson was illegitimate, despite everything he tried to say. He's always claimed he didn't know who his father was, but he always did.
What became of his mother and his father?
William Manson divorced his wife, Kathleen, when Charlie was still very young. His mother moved to the West Coast.
After she got out of prison.
After she got out of prison. Manson moved with her. He likes to say that she tried to sell him for a pitcher of beer and didn't care about him. But the truth is that he was an incorrigible child that they tried to place in different schools for boys so that he'd get some sort of discipline. The picture on the cover of my book is when he's 13. That's the day he comes before a judge in Indianapolis on charges of armed robbery, convinces the judge that he is a Catholic, even though he's not, and the judge sends him to Boys Town rather than a reformatory. 3 days later, Charlie steals a priest's car and sets out for the West Coast. Everything that he did later on, the days that he became famous, iconic, are simply the same pattern that he exhibited his entire life.
So you called the book The Life and Times of Charles Manson and explained that you wanted to look at this period overall. What was it about this particular time and this person that maybe have led to or explained in some way the murders?
Charles Manson was someone who took advantage of every cultural change and interest to further his own evil intentions. Many people say, oh, well, Manson's a child of the 60s, a product of the 60s. And he is. But he was also a product of the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. He got most of his guru rap by cribbing directly from Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People and the Nazarene church services that his grandma forced him to attend. There was nothing original about him, but he could take advantage of the times. You may remember 1967, the Summer of Love. By horrible coincidence, Manson is paroled from prison and ends up in Haight-Ashbury. He sees the gurus who are getting young women to follow them and indulge them in every whim. Charlie had been a low-level pimp, but now he sees the opportunity to become something greater.
Put that Dale Carnegie into action.
When I talked to Patricia Krenwinkel and Leslie Van Houten in the California Institution for Women Prison.
And those are two members of the family.
Right, who are currently serving life sentences for the Tate LaBianca murders. I said to them, what in the world could Charlie Manson have said to you when you first met him that made you want to follow him? And they said, oh, it was like he was reading our minds and he said this, this, and this. And if you looked at Chapter 7 in How to Win Friends and Influence People, word for word, that's what Manson was using.
He also had some interesting advice, Carnegie, that is less well known about sex being a motivating force. Tell us what that
Well, in the textbook, Dale Carnegie writes that everything human beings do is based on one of two motivations, the sexual urge or the urge to be famous. Charlie had both of those, and Dale Carnegie really was Manson's guru. Carnegie was to Manson as the Maharishi was to the Beatles.
Wow. Well, very different results. You spoke to these women in prison. Tell us what they were like.
It was an odd experience with both women. Leslie Van Houten was one of the very few women in the Manson family who was pretty, vivacious, outgoing. And she was 20 when the crimes were committed, and she's been in prison for almost 44 years. It's like she's caught in amber. She still has the 20-year-old girl mannerisms, playing with her hair, smiling, putting her hand on your arm when she talks to you. Patricia Krenwinkel.
Does she have regret, remorse over this? Did she?
Both of them are remorseful, and both of them dedicate themselves to programs in the prison to help others. Van Houten, who, by the way, has just received her master's degree in philosophy, has started an English as second language program for illiterate young inmates. Krenwinkel takes rescue dogs and trains them to be guide dogs for the blind. And when they look back on these years, they talk about the heavy drug usage, but most of all, they talk about Manson's ability to dominate a person mentally. He was always very careful to isolate the family members, Spahn Ranch, the Mojave Desert, so that he would be the only influence on them.
And is there any correspondence between any of them now? Do they know
Manson each other? Still writes to Krenwinkel and Van Houten. When I was visiting Leslie Van Houten, she'd just gotten a letter from him, and the letter simply said, "You wanted to change the world, but you let the world change you." To this day, Manson still considers himself the reincarnation of Jesus Christ. It's an odd thing. And of course, he has many, many current followers. That was a surprise to me.
Well, so does Leslie write back?
To Manson, no. Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel both now loathe Manson. And though they take responsibility for the crimes they committed, they also believe that without him, it wouldn't have happened.
There's that famous photograph of the three, of Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten, as they are headed into court, X's on their forehead. Do you show that to them and sort of say, like, what do you make of this now?
Manson orchestrated not just the murders, but even the trial. There was a soundproof room where every morning during the trial, Manson, the three women, and their attorneys would meet to discuss strategy for the day. And Manson would lay out for the women what they were supposed to do during the trial, that when this person testifies and I tug my ear, you're all going to stand up and bat like sheep to indicate that this is just somebody who's doing what the government told them to do. They're both very honest about the fact that Manson told them up front, every woman in the family, your only purpose is to use sex to get men to join the family, that they would be assigned to the men that Charlie wanted to impress and do whatever they wanted. They talk about shoplifting. They talk about mugging people. And of course, they were very graphic about the nights of the murder, so much so that it was difficult for me even to listen to some of the things they were saying.
And how did they, I mean, what were they like when they told you about these, the murders?
Leslie Van Houten has done a number of interviews, and she more or less has the story in a comfortable way for her to tell it. Besides a couple sound bites on the 25th anniversary of the murders, Patricia Krenwinkel has never given a full interview. She's never even talked to the police about the specific events of that night. And so as she walked me through it, she actually answered questions that the LAPD still had about the nights of the Tate murders, including the fact that after the killings were accomplished, Manson himself went back to the house and rearranged the bodies and furniture so that it would make a much more sensational appearance when the bodies were discovered.
How did you get her to talk to you?
Well, first I talked to Van Houten. I had come in contact with someone she knew, one of her college professors. As I said, she just got her master's in philosophy. The professor said he would see if Van Houten would talk with me. She did. I went to see her three times in California. And Patricia Krenwinkel's in the same prison. They are not close at all anymore. On my third visit, I said to Leslie, I just want you to be aware that I'm going to try to contact Patricia Krenwinkel, see if she'll talk to me. And she said, oh, it's all right. I've already talked to Pat about you. And she's decided you're the one she wants to talk to. It was cathartic, I think, for Patricia Krenwinkel to talk to me. As she talked about the nights of the murder, she broke down sobbing. She walked me through step by step, even answered the question how one person was permitted to live that night. No one ever understood why William Gerritsen, the caretaker in the guest house, was left alone. Krenwinkel described how she chased a young woman named Abigail Folger out into the lawn, kept stabbing her, how it hurt her hand when the knife hit bone rather than internal organs. and how Tex Watson, who was orchestrating the killings that night, said to her, go find who's ever in the house and back and kill them. Krenwinkel had a dizzy spell as she walked around the corner behind the main house.
How old was she at this time?
24. Mm-hmm. She had a dizzy spell. Instead of going all the way to the guest house, she just leaned against the wall out of Watson's sight. When the dizzy spell passed, she came back to Watson and said, I looked in the window. There was no one there. That's why one person lived that night.
You also spoke with Manson's sister and cousin, and you maintain their anonymity, which
right.
is understandable. Tell us about the sister. What is she like?
She is a wonderful lady who has spent all these years trying not to be found.
What's her fear? I mean, what is she?
Manson has current followers.
Yes.
They do carry out his instructions that he sends them from prison. And both Nancy, his sister, and Joanne, his cousin, have fear for their own safety, and you can't blame them.
Yeah.
It was important to talk to Nancy because that is how we learned the real story of Kathleen, Manson's mother. All we've ever had to go on is what Manson had to say about her, and he made it all up.
Had nobody tried to talk to her before?
They have never been found before.
How did you find her?
That I really can't talk about too much, but it took almost a year and a half. And I didn't want to just knock on Nancy and Joanne's door and say, hi, this is what you've been dreading.
The dread investigative reporter
right.
from the Fort Star.
So when I found them, their addresses, I sent them registered letters. This is who I am. May I send you a couple of my books so you can see the kind of writing I do? But I sent them the books, talked to them on the phone, and then each in turn invited me to come out and visit with them, which I did. They did not know each other existed. And I've been able to get them in touch. So now they've got a new family relationship.
Very different kind of family reunion.
Well, you know, they share some things. Manson is so repugnant to so many people that they're afraid if anyone knows they're related to him, that will affect the way people treat them. And I think it probably would. Joanne in particular, you know, has children and grandchildren who have no idea that they are, in fact, related to Uncle Charlie Manson.
Is she scared of him?
Yes. The first person Manson attempted to murder was his cousin Joanne. When he was 7 years old, he attacked her with a sickle that he had gotten from their backyard. Everything we see about him, it's nothing new. I asked Joanne, what did you think when you pick up a newspaper one day and read that your cousin Charles Manson has been arrested for the infamous Tate-LaBianca murders? Were you surprised? She said, no, I wasn't surprised. Like anybody else who knew Charlie when he was growing up, the only thing I wondered about was, why did this take so long?
You were an investigative reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram for many years and also the books editor.
Right.
And you've written 16 books.
Yes.
Several of them, in addition to the more obvious ones, a book about Bonnie and Clyde, a book about the shootout at the OK Corral, were about Mr. and Mrs. Santa Claus. Can
yes.
you just – we have to ask.
Of course you do. All of my books, in one way or another, try to contrast real history to mythology. When my sons were in junior high, they would gripe around Christmas time when their mother would want them to help decorate the house, and they'd say, why do we have to put up stockings? Whose stupid idea was this anyway? So I thought, well, let's go down to Barnes & Noble and find a book about Christmas, the history of Christmas. I couldn't find one. I decided to write one.
You went directly to the source.
Well, I thought, I don't want to spoil the magic of the holiday, so why don't I write a book that's got the real history of all these Christmas traditions, but we'll have Santa Claus telling the story. And up to that point, I had written 8 books, which had all sold in the dozens. And so I expected the same thing to happen with this one. And then it sold 250,000 copies and, lo and behold, ended up on the New York Times bestseller list and let me quit my day job. So I'm always very grateful and say that
a gift from Santa.
Without Santa Claus, my late life career would not have been possible.
All right. Well, from Santa Claus to Charles Manson, Jeff Gwynn, thank you so much for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
Carl Sagal is here to talk about bestsellers. Welcome, Parle.
Hi, thanks, Pamela.
What is new this week?
Well, there's a lot of action on the list this week.
And we're on the hardcover print, right?
That's right. Okay. So on the hardcover fiction list, The Cuckoo's Calling by J.K. Rowling, writing as Robert Galbraith, is still holding strong. But at number two is Mistress by James Patterson and David Ellis, which is about a man sort of uncovering the double life of this woman he's fixated on. At number six is Hotshot by Julie Garwood. And at number eight, another thriller, The Last Witness by W.E.B. Griffin and William E. Butterworth IV. Speaking of amazing author names. At number 10 is The Companions by R.A. Salvatore, which is book one of a sprawling new fantasy series called The Sundering. And at 11, The Husband's Secret by the Australian writer Leanne Moriarty, which is about, again, another double life, a woman uncovering sort of her husband's very dark secrets.
It's a week of true beach reads here.
It is. I think it's, is it like the Gone Girl phenomenon? I'm not sure, but every other book on this list seemed to be something like this. And the rest of the list is, you know, fiction stalwarts. We have Dan Brown, Daniel Steele.
Or Gone Girl.
And George R. R. Martin. In nonfiction, there are lots of new entrants as well. Reza Aslan is still number one with his biography of Jesus. And he's followed by Lean In by Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Leibovich's This Town, which have been sort of quarreling over the number two spot. J.W. Richards' book, Infiltrated, appropriately enough, infiltrates at number four. And he sort of talks about how the financial crisis is allowing this army of, you know, self-proclaimed activists and philanthropists and politicians to sort of infiltrate the FDIC and the Treasury. At number six, we have Lawrence in Arabia by Scott Anderson. And at number nine, we have The Sports Gene by David Epstein, which I'm very interested in. And basically what he does is he sort of, you know, refutes that 10,000 hours of practice idea that Malcolm Gladwell popularized in Outliers, saying that, you know, if you practice for 10,000 hours, you'll achieve a certain level of excellence. And he sort of says that, you know, not everybody's hour of practice is the same way. We don't advance at the same rate.
So do you have the gene?
Do I have the sports gene? I'm sorry to say the Sagals have the anti-sports gene. We have the sitting gene.
We have the book gene here, the book review.
We are potted plants. And I mean, and it's going to be a controversial book because he does ask these questions. And he does say, well, you know, look at, like, you know, Black Americans dominated track and field. Is there something about Africa's geography and the kinds of bodies you develop sort of to succeed and live in that kind of land that gives you a leg up? He also looks at sports dogs.
No pun intended.
No, I'm terrible. He looks at sled dogs. He looks at, like, Finnish cross-country skiers. And he looks at sort of like, well, how is this going to change who we recruit to be our athletes? Are we going to become like China, which, you know, screens kids very early? They do this thing for diving. You hold your arms over your head. And if your elbows are at a certain length, a certain distance above your ears, they phase you out because that will create too much of a splash. So are we going to just, you know, become like tremendously competitive in that way.
Enough about foreign affairs. What else is on the list?
Speaking of domestic affairs in every possible way, at number 10, we have These Few Precious Days by Christopher Anderson, which is a book about, you know, mainly the last couple of years of Jack and Jackie Kennedy, which were both, you know, he sort of describes as like amphetamine fueled and full of like Jack's infidelities, but really sort of tender, surprisingly tender at various points, and it's full of sort of like juicy stories of Marilyn Monroe calling Jackie Kennedy, being like, I'm going to be the next first lady. And Jackie said, well, all the trouble will be yours. And
now, is this the first entry in the onslaught of books about JFK leading up to the anniversary that's made it to the list?
As far as I can tell, it is. And it's probably certainly the juiciest. At 11, we have Collision 2012, by Dan Balls, a Washington Post chief correspondent, which is also a very insidery look at the election of 2012. And at number 13, appropriately, we have Manson by Jeff Gwynn, a biography that sort of puts Manson in the context of not only the music industry, but sort of traces how his psychopathology started showing up at a very young, early age, and sort of the roots of his charisma, how much he borrowed from Christianity and Dale Carnegie and sort of all sorts of unexpected sources.
And of course, we heard from Gwynn himself earlier.
That's right. So a ghoulish summer reading list.
Thanks, Parle.
Thank you, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.